BCFM's Politics Show with me, Tony Gosling. Israel leads the way in surveillance and software, but does it give Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Israeli government and the military a backdoor into the NSA and GCHQ if they're using it? Also, the old controversy, can the MMR vaccine cause autism? US manufacturer Merck are embroiled in a controversy also about the Alzheimer's drugs that they produce, as well as the MMR vaccine. But since a whistleblower, Dr. William Thompson, surfaced in the United States from the Center for Disease Control, it's pretty clear big money's trying to cover up links between the vaccine and autism. Why haven't we been told about it? Well, the film, which does, Vaxxed, has been censored. We start this week by looking at the Bristol Channel and Severn Estuary, home to four nuclear power station sites, Wilfer, Barkley, Oldbury and Hinckley. But it's a 50-foot or 15-metre tidal range means make it one of the two best spots in the whole world for renewable tidal power. The Bay of Fundy in Nova Scotia, which is, funnily enough, where Genoese explorer John Cabot sailed from Bristol to in the Matthew and claimed it in 1497. That's the other place. Gloucestershire County surveyor Thomas Fulljames recognised the Severn Estuary's tidal power potential over 150 years ago, and his 1849 scheme included a bridge, the first design for a bridge across the Severn. At that point, I might add. There's also the MayGen scheme in Pentland off the northeast coast of Scotland. That's using enormous 400 megawatt underwater turbines. And it was opened by Nicola Sturgeon in mid-September with little recognition by the London media. So we're going to do the sums now and ask what's best for the Bristol Channel with environmental journalist Paul Mobbs. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello.
Paul, tell us a little bit about yourself. What's your background?
I worked in the engineering industry 20-odd years ago, and then I sort of did my dream job, which was being an environmental consultant for community groups. And ever since, I've just been going around the country doing this, incinerators, landfills, contaminated land sites. If it's nasty, I've probably been there.
But when you say engineering, lots of different sorts, what were you actually doing?
I was an electrical mechanical engineer. And so when I go and look at an industrial site, that's really useful because I can understand what I'm looking at. And I do a lot of work around energy. And when you look at, let's say, a PV panel, there's all sorts of things that go into making that PV panel before you start getting...
That's a solar panel.
Yeah, a solar panel. Yeah, well, a solar electricity panel. Because this is one of the interesting things, the interesting arguments I have, that everybody looks at solar PV, the things you put in your roof to make electric. For every pound you were to put into it, you'd get 30 times more energy from a solar hot water panel. So why do people obsess about electricity? It's because electricity is considered to be more sexy than hot water.
Do these hot water panels, do they actually work then?
They work far better than the PV panels.
Why is that?
They will produce far more power in cloudy skies when PV panels will not.
So why is that?
It's because they're using a different bit of the electromagnetic spectrum to get energy from. They're using the infrared, which will shine through the clouds from the sun, even when there's not enough visible light to make the PV panels produce electricity.
Amazing. Well, that's something. First thing I've learnt this evening. I'm sure I'm going to learn a lot more. But look, what about our area here? The Bristol Channel really is, and always has been, one of the prime sites on the planet Earth. And Thomas Fulljames probably recognised this back in 1849, but still really nothing going on as regards tidal power. Why do you think that might be?
If I put my geek hat on, it's all due to the energy density of fuel. That the more energy you can pack into a smaller space, the more money you can make out of it. And the unique selling proposition of fossil fuels has always been that from a little bit of fuel, you get a lot of energy. Well, renewable power isn't like that. It's more diffuse. So you need some big equipment to capture it. If you think of wind turbines, you know, the size of a big wind turbine, it is big. Because in order to get a lot of energy, you need big equipment. And it's the same for tidal power. tidal power is, well, let's say the underwater tidal turbines they're building at the moment. Water is much more dense than air, about 800 times more dense. So for the same size turbine, you'll get 800 times more power than wind. So why haven't we done tidal turbines? It's because all the extra complexity of building something underwater, getting it out there, having divers to look after it, it's more complicated than doing it on the surface.
Well, we've been doing North Sea oil, haven't we, for decades?
North Sea oil is mostly big pieces of kit you go and dump in the sea. It's not quite the same level of finesse as you need to look after underwater equipment.
So have you got any theories why we've heard so little about this scheme up north of Scotland? Because, I mean, looking at you would expect that there would be almost a national celebration over this. The biggest tidal scheme in the world, MayGen is saying it is. It's at Pentland, which is just off the northeast coast of Scotland. These are massive, brand new, 400 megawatt underwater turbines. And like I say, the biggest one in the world was open the whole scheme started, really, just this September. And hardly a whisper about it at the same time as we were hearing all the fun and games in the national media about Hinkley Point.
Everybody talks about this government's policies on immigration or, you know, on climate change. You think about that attitude. You know, they do not like renewables. To them, renewables are some kind of weird hippie-type thing that they shouldn't be looking at because it's not good for business.
Why?
Because that's their ideology. And we are living in times when politics has become extremely, after many years of sort of ebb and flow, we've got an extremely ideological government. And that's not good, because that instantly shuts down whole areas of discussion. If you think of fracking, there is huge amounts of fracking. There was a bill in the Irish Parliament this week to ban fracking in Ireland. And we haven't heard anything about that. There are countries around the world banning fracking. Germany has recently banned fracking. We don't hear that in our news because our government is all for it. And it's because they see fossil fuels and, more importantly, big investment in big projects as being good for Britain. And if we think of Heathrow or Hinkley C or HS2, big projects, big money, that's how they see the world.
It's a bit sad, isn't it, when the government is thinking simply in a kind of almost lizard-brained point of view. Well, we could have one or two mega schemes rather than lots of little schemes. Actually, for many of us, it's the smaller schemes, the more local schemes, that are what we want.
Not just that, but from my engineering point of view, a big scheme is a single point of failure. They keep on about, oh, Hinkley C will be 7% of Britain's electricity. On paper, that's true. But it also means that if Hinkley C broke, then we lose 7% of our electricity. Whereas if you had lots of small schemes all over the place, working into local grids, distributed generation, all the stuff that the energy industry is looking to do instead of looking back, it's far more secure. It's far more secure from natural disasters, flooding or whatever. Don't forget that Hinkley Sea is on the Bristol Channel, where you theoretically could have a huge tidal surge like a Fukushima. So there are all sorts of reasons why at an engineering level, energy technology level, and basic common sense, Hinkley Sea doesn't work.
What about the figures, though? Because most people would point the finger at both you and me and say, well, look, there's no way that tidal power is ever going to generate the sort of power that Hinkley would.
That's true. But this is the problem. That, again, you remember I said about everybody looks at PV panels on roofs and thinks they're sexy. Whenever politicians talk about energy, they actually mean electricity. And electricity is only a fifth of what we consume. The other four-fifths is a mixture of home heating and road fuel. And that's the problem. We have a debate, even amongst the campaign groups, that is skewed towards electricity. And actually, electricity... yes, we need it for certain important things, but it's not the thing that makes our economy work.
Okay, electricity then. What would you like to see if you were involved a bit more? So, okay, let's give you the job, Secretary of State for the Environment or Energy or whatever. What would you like to see in order to put the nation straight on, number one, I suppose, reducing consumption of electricity, and number two, plotting a path into the future where renewables are taking over from fossil fuels and from nuclear?
There is an interesting argument at the moment that the government have just introduced... Well, the government scrapped all the requirements for eco-homes to reduce demand, for new homes. But they've just introduced a requirement from a law from the last parliament that if you rent a home, it has to be a certain energy standard. And there's a huge lobby because it means landlords will have to invest in reducing the energy consumption of their buildings so that the tenants won't have to pay a fortune to heat them. And there is no simple solution here. If I were in charge, apart from the fact there will probably be a revolution very shortly afterwards, it's all about reducing demand. Now, we are reducing demand. We have been reducing our energy consumption in this country for the last 10 years. And that's for one very simple reason, recession. And if you look at the history of energy consumption, we have only ever cut energy consumption during recessions. Now, what this fundamentally comes down to is the laws of physics say you cannot have constant growth in a finite environment. And yet our entire political dialogue is all about creating constant growth. And so the first thing we have to sort out is not energy, it's the ideology that underpins all government decisions.
How do you do that?
Well, interestingly, the whole history of economic growth, everybody thinks that economic growth is inevitable. It's the thing that everybody, you know, has to do. Well, we've only had that policy in this country for 50 years. And even the man who invented that GDP figure in 1929, he resigned his job because he believed the American government wasn't using it in the way that he had invented it. And politicians can use this one very stupid figure to say that they're doing brilliantly. But actually, the whole economic growth thing, it's a bit like, you know, if you, over the water from Bristol, you've got Aberfoyle Power Station. And recently the government were crowing that they had spent a few hundred million pounds putting flue gas desulfurisation on Aberfoyle Power Station so it could keep burning Welsh coal. Well, they've just had a European court judgment against the power station because it's emitting so high a level of nitrogen dioxide, it's harming people's health. So, again, there is no zero cost source of energy. But what it comes down to is you cannot have a constantly growing economy. And so my favourite, when I do talks, everybody has a mobile phone or a laptop. You are 5% of the life consumption of that device. So if you have a laptop, you use it for 2 years, the energy consumed where you're using it is about 5% of what it consumes. And that's because just making the memory chip in that laptop takes more energy than you ever put into it. So while we have an environment where you use a laptop for 2 years and then you junk it, well, yes, we're going to consume huge amounts of energy. It would be quite easy to make a laptop to last 20 years. I've got ones in my office that have been running for 10 years. If you can make goods last longer, you make them repairable, you make them serviceable, you're going to have a huge impact on how much energy and resources we use. The other big one is if you take the average person in Britain, you analyse their life, what makes them tick, you put more energy per person per day into your mouth in the form of food than you do into your house per person per day. And that's because of the way we produce food. So all those people in Bristol who do permaculture and have their allotments, they are doing far more to address climate change than the people who have green energy tariffs.
Okay, what about road fuel? I mean, you know, you brought the subject up, and it's a biggie, isn't it? I mean, we've got this wonderful metro bus being built here in Bristol right now, which is a guided bus scheme. Many people point to it as being a kind of almost pointless halfway house between the bus and the tram. But for many of us, we're tearing our hair out as trying to get back and forth to work is becoming more and more difficult, more and more congestion. There's got to be a better way, Paul.
Bus is a very useful little way of knocking more than three quarters off the road fuel budget. And don't forget that
buses don't go where you want them to go, though. The car does.
That's because people want to get in outside their house, go to where they want to and get out. And the fact is about cars, you know, you're paying for something, you're only using 2% of its life. And that's the point. Cars are a very good way of making people consume for something to sit and do nothing for most of its life.
The other thing, of course, is they're very handy for going out with the family at weekends as well, aren't they?
I've never had a car. I don't have a driving license. I travel all over the country. I work with groups all over the country. It's doable with the public transport system we have now. Admittedly, it's got difficult in the last year because they've chopped.
I think it's very brave of you, Paul. I mean, if it was me, I'd be tearing my hair out, because sometimes you think, we're looking at a journey, not only is it going to take you a whole day to get from A to B, and you then have to wonder how am I going to get back again, but also the cost.
Compared to having a car, I mean, this is the thing that once you've got a car, you have an excuse to use it all the time. Whereas you look at the costs of not having a car versus having a car, it's not that much different. Because most of the time you have a car, it's not doing anything.
Okay, well, look, on this business of looking at these various sides of things, what about home heating? I mean, you've mentioned water, that you can have solar panel on your roof, which will heat your water up. What about, just generally central heating, or however you keep your home warm, making that so you're consuming less?
I have a lovely exercise I do. I get people in my talks to put their hands up and shake them, twist them. And the thing is, in this country, the average temperature of the house, measured by the Building Research Establishment, is something about 21.5 degrees. For every degree you turn down the thermostat, you save 10% on your household heating. So if you go from 21 down to 17, which is doable, and you will acclimatise, it takes a few weeks, but you will acclimatise to that, you're saving 40% off your bill.
That sounds about the simplest thing, but I mean, you don't want to have to go around all the time with a woolly jumper on, do you?
Why not? Have you never seen a
You do that, I can imagine.
Have you never seen a Actually, no, I'm sat here in shorts. Have you never seen a Swedish... whatever? Yeah, you're talking about fashion. You're not talking about technology. You're talking about the stuff between people's ears.
Okay, well, let's get back to the Bristol Channel. That's where we started. Can you just give us an idea of the sort of costs and the possibility and the actual benefits of having Tidal here rather than Hinkley? I mean, how does it all stack up financially?
Cost is a big one, because our government hides all sorts of subsidies through things like tax breaks. So the frackers at the moment are getting a 60% tax relief on all the money they spend, which is why a lot of people invest in things like fracking. It's a way of dodging tax on large sums of money.
Well, they're putting a big incentive onto that specific type of energy, aren't they?
It is, but there comes a point where the incentive is so great that people invest in it not because it's an energy source, but because it's a way of addressing their tax. And when it comes to the way we build and commission this stuff, if you can guarantee you're going to build 2,000, and government policy will not change. The problem we have at the moment is government policy is one thing. We have a different government come in, and the whole government policy gets junked, and everybody gets put out of work again. And that makes stuff expensive. That is adding to the cost of wind turbines or PV panels. If we can absolutely have a policy which people know that if they invest for 10 or 20 years, they're going to get their money back. It will be cheaper. But also, at the moment, the government is requiring all these companies to go off and get money on the commercial money market. If you look at Germany, various other countries, they go to the government and borrow the money from the government at a far cheaper rate. And that, in turn, means the energy is cheaper. And it's a bit more complicated than just how much does this piece of kit cost. It's all about how the government decides to invest. And at the moment, they've passed a law a couple of years ago that we have to maximise the economic recovery of fossil fuels in this country. And so they're all about encouraging fossil fuels, not about encouraging energy conservation. Energy conservation being the perfect example, whereas if you go buy a roll of stuff to put in your roof, you have to pay VAT on it. If it's a new build house, you don't. And so, again, everything is skewed towards consumption. It's not skewed towards minimising how much energy we're using or building the best solutions over the long term.
Now, I know you've done a little estimate for me, which was very kind of you, saying that you think that there would need to be about 2,660 tidal energy rigs. These are these things that they're building up in Scotland to make One Hinckley.
Yeah.
I mean, what would be the differences in... I mean, you were talking there, I think it's just fascinating, this side of things, about just the finance for this. You know, so it may be that because this is money that's coming from the government, that the interest rates are so low, etc., that something becomes viable where another thing doesn't. What do you think it would cost to do something like that?
So let's look at Hinckley. The final price tag of Hinckley, there are huge variances in the price because everybody's looking at different things. Hinckley doesn't have to pay insurance for the major disasters. Our government picks up the tab for that. That's a subsidy. Hinckley, the money to pay to build it is coming from the French government and the Chinese government. So it's very low interest rates compared to somebody wanting to go and build tidal turbines where they have to go to the money market and they might be paying 4 or 5 times more for the interest rate. And so assessing Hinckley versus, let's say, Maygen has all sorts of problems because we're not looking at the same thing. But just on paper, with the stated price of Hinckley, if a Maygen turbine was less than £7 million, it's cheaper than Hinckley. And probably they are.
So, I mean, how do you work that one out?
Well, they spent £20 million on the prototype. And the thing about a prototype is it's lots of engineers having great fun cutting bits of metal and welding them together. And so it's very expensive. If you can turn that into a production line with hundreds of people in jobs...
Hey, that's a good idea. People need jobs.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. And then you turn that into, let's say, a 10-year project to keep those people in jobs. And, I mean, Denmark's really interesting. That we were world leaders in wind turbines in the 1970s. And then when Margaret Thatcher came in, we just junked the whole technology. Denmark picked all that up, and they have now got a huge export industry in Denmark sending wind turbines around the world. And this is the whole point. If you go forward and you develop these technologies, you're not just doing it for yourself. You're creating an industry where you can then export that technology to other people. Whereas we're importing the technology for Hinckley.
Frustrating, isn't it? So, I mean, is it fair to say that actually it could be viable doing a tidal version of Hinckley, even though it's a much, much bigger scheme? It would take much longer to finish?
I don't think the total time would be that much different, because if you look at the two other sites where the French are building these nuclear power stations, they're years behind schedule. In the end, it comes down to what does the government want. It actually doesn't come down to what people want. The vast majority of people in this country do not want fracking, and yet it's going ahead. It comes down to what government wants, and that's all about ideology. And at the moment, I mean, we look across the water to Trump and what Trump is thinking. Actually, we're there in this country with a lot of what Trump wants. We're cutting renewables, we're cutting science. I lecture on university courses, and one of those courses is being closed at the moment because people don't want to have the word sustainability on their CV because it might harm their employment prospects.
Well, hang on. What course is that? And it's sad to hear that those important types of courses are closing. Which course is it?
I wouldn't like to identify the institution.
No, okay, but what's the course called?
It's Sustainable Development Advocacy. And the thing is that if you look at all the recent cuts to councils or companies, they're getting rid of the people who sit in offices and check if what the company is doing is legal from the environmental point of view. All those people are being cut.
That's tragic. Absolutely.
And the moment
tragic.
You start cutting those people, that means that people like me then have to go around and help the communities fight stuff which they shouldn't be having to fight because it's illegal.
Absolutely tragic, Paul. So sad to hear that. But look, I mean, on the other side of the fence, you've got the fossil fuel lobby, haven't you? The energy lobby, the nuclear lobby. These people are minted.
That's because they fit in with the ideology, the economic ideology. And ultimately, that's what economics is. It's an ideology. Economics is not a science. It's not... there's a man called Professor Paul Romer. He is one of the leading figures in macroeconomics. He is the man. He is the man who did endogenous growth theory in the 1980s, which Reagan and Thatcher worshipped. He brought out a paper in September saying, I don't know if this works anymore. I can't relate any of our theories to what's actually going on in the world. You haven't heard that on the news, have you? Because that throws into doubt all current government economic policy, because it might just be complete mumbo jumbo.
Can you give us any specific examples about here in Britain where particular individuals have been lobbied or closely connected with, received money from these fossil fuel companies?
I did some research for a group called Talk Fracking at the beginning of the year. If you put Frackademic in Google, you'll find it.
And or your favourite search engine, not necessarily Google. Yep.
True, yep. But what this space is looking at is where the money is coming from for academia. Now, the thing is, George Osborne, he hobbled higher education by saying, if you want to do research, particularly postgraduate research, where we make our experts, you have to get into a scheme with some corporate funders. And so they developed these things called Centres for Doctoral Research. And so the fossil fuel companies are funding research into fossil fuels with government money and with private money at our universities. But of course that means, in a way, the companies are getting to call what the university do and do not look at. So whereas before an academic could go along and look at quite a broad range of things, they're being forced by financial pressure to look at a very narrow set of things which just work into this big idea of big projects and big economic models.
So sorry to interrupt you, Paul, but any specific individuals, people that you know of in the British system?
Chris Smith would be the ideal example. He chaired something called the Shale Gas Task Force, and he appeared before a Commons committee last year saying that they were going to do all this independent research, and this independent research would state the safety case for fracking in Britain. It was funded by the fossil fuel companies and the people with interest in fracking. It was run by a PR company called Edelman, who have a long track record in fronting difficult issues for big carbon, big pharma and everybody else.
I mean, are we saying effectively that smaller industries like the wind power and the tidal power industries simply don't have the spare profits sloshing around in their bank accounts to hire these massive lobbying firms like Edelman? Because, I mean, those are the sorts of people who would have been involved in lobbying maybe perhaps for some big scheme like Hinkley.
That's pretty much it. Cars are a good example. There's various estimates, but about 10% of the price you pay for a car is to pay for its advertising. And a lot of really big industries spending 10, 20, 30 million quid to pay a PR company to set up lots of false Twitter accounts of robots tweeting for you. A lot of problem we have in the media today is that journalists are so rushed, they get whole packages sent to them, they can just cut and paste. And again, there's a lovely setup at the Wellcome Trust in London called the Science Media Centre. And I, as part of this academic work, I took Science Media Centre press releases and word searched with a computer program on the internet of all the major newspapers. And you can see how major newspapers just cut and paste this material from the Science Media Centre on things like GMOs, drugs, all sorts of things.
Well, we're going to be talking, actually, after we finish chatting to you, Paul, we're going to be talking about this film, Vaxxed, and listening to Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who's been fighting an uphill battle, really, a smear campaign against him for drawing, medically very watertight links between the MMR vaccine, which is manufactured by a big, powerful US drug firm, and Merck, and he has actually, I mean, if you go online and look for him, you'll find the discredited blah blah blah. Now it looks as if the pharmaceutical industry is a little bit like the energy industry, in that it's basically twisting the truth on the internet and in the mainstream media to its own designs.
And again, they're the people who tend to fund things like Science Media Centre. If you go to the Science Media Centre and look at who funds them, it's big engineering, weapons, nuclear power, big energy. And that's the whole point, that if you're somebody... I use Linux, which is free and open source software.
This is a replacement for Windows, basically.
It's not a replacement, it's better. And the reason you never hear of it, it's free and open source. You can download it for nothing. And they haven't got an advertising budget for that obvious reason. And this is a problem today, that the media, the internet, I mean, I was one of those people who got on the internet in the 1980s. And in the 1990s, we thought it was going to be brilliant. But it's been stitched up by big advertising.
Look, what about these wider questions? Fascinating to hear your analysis of, you know, the possibilities, actually, we could be doing tidal power down in Bristol Channel. But what about the wider issues to do with climate change, for example? I mean, we've had some reports on this show over the last few weeks about the lack of sea ice, for example, around the North Pole. The fact that the North Pole is getting thinner, even though it, you know, it might not look quite so bad from space, the actual amount of ice is getting thinner, and it's like the little ice cube in our gin and tonic is getting smaller and smaller.
Climate is only one of a number of different environmental pressures. The reason the government's latched onto climate was because it happens after the economic process, you can retrofit things and sell them. You know, there's eight things that are driving unsustainability, and actually climate isn't the worst. We're running out of certain resources, so the minerals in mobile phones, we're running out of those because they're not recycled. There's a whole load of different things what we would consider essential to our everyday life, and they are running out, and it's because of this whole idea of growth and consumption. Now, there's some wonderful stuff came out a couple of years ago. Remember the limits to growth in 1972?
This is Club of Rome, infamous Club of Rome report.
They made a fatal mistake. They didn't label their axes. You know, you're drummed into it, you at school, you always label your axes. Various governments have sponsored reports to reassess the limits to growth model, and they all come back and say the same thing. It's spot on. It's one of the most successful projections in econometric history.
I mean, would it be fair to say that the more growth you get, the less quality of life? It does seem as if that's where we're heading.
Define quality of life.
Well, having leisure time, that sort of thing.
Well, it's interesting you said about the hassle about taking a public transport journey. You have to get somewhere by a certain time. That is half the problem, that people are forced into cramming more and more in their everyday lives. But the thing is, you only have a finite amount of time. And in the end, you're multitasking different forms of consumption. You're washing up whilst watching the TV. You're doing your computer while watching Fox or something. And there's only so far that can go. And yet, and this is all foreseen. There was a lovely book in the 1970s called The Harried Leisure Class, which was written by a Harvard social economist. And he was saying the last barrier in economics is getting people to pay for their spare time. And everything he advocated in that book about basically monetizing us having spare time has happened. And that's the pressure that we feel today.
Well, I mean, I was just literally watching an interview with Prime Minister Harold Wilson from the 1970s the other day, and he had a big smile on his face saying, well, it looks as if, you know, we may actually start having a massive increase in our leisure time because of automation.
And that was the idea of automation, and it would mean that we didn't have to work. But if you look at particularly women, they have been exploited more than anybody because they were exploited in the home. Then all these devices came along to make homework easier, but then they had to go out to work. And that, in a way, is that same process trying to exploit people to work more to get money. But as we start to approach these ecological limits and prices rise, which has been the case for the last 10 to 15 years, it gets harder and harder to make that model work.
Okay, well, look, let's get back to this climate change business, Paul, because I know you're pretty hot on it. Tell us where you think we're heading and if there are any models to stop global warming that are looking like they may actually work.
At the moment, we're heading for 6 degrees. We're heading for Armageddon. And there's no way off of that because...
Do you say 6 degrees? What's that?
Because if you look at the data of the current trends, and everybody thinks about it's just us who have to cut emissions. We have to cut emissions by a certain date, or the response of the environment will start releasing even more greenhouse gases. So as all that Arctic permafrost melts up in Siberia and northern Canada, it releases methane and carbon, which adds to the problem. And this is the whole thing about tipping points, that you only have to get to the tipping point and nature will do the rest. And because we're not addressing cutting very, very quickly in the short term, all the politicians want to kick it away to 2030 or after, we're not going to stop the tipping point. And that's why we're heading for a much hotter world than the political world likes to talk about.
Also, I mean, it's quite clear the Western world is pretty entirely addicted to oil, and it looks like that has been a deliberate policy since the Second World War, to get everybody addicted to oil. Everybody needs it, you know, filling up our cars with diesel, petrol, etc. What about peak oil? We haven't heard a lot about that recently. Is that what do you make of that, Paul?
I did some work last year. If you take the fracking oil and the Canadian tar sands out of the equation, then world oil consumption has stalled. It hasn't gone up in 10 years. And the thing is, this started 160 years ago. So you are going to get this long, drawn-out plateau where oil production will just sort of undulate at about the same level for 10 to 20 years, then start to fall. And you have to ask yourself, why all of a sudden are the Saudis wanting to sell their oil company? What do they know that we don't? And a lot of people who look at long-term energy trends, they're very suspicious of this sudden Saudi move, because as they see it, we are at this limit. And things like fracking are the perfect example of why you're at this limit. That if you have to put in 10 times the amount of engineering and money to get the same amount of fuel back, that's a perfect illustration that you're at the peak.
Also, I mean, there may be some geopolitical reasons why the Saudis might be being kind of persuaded to sell their own oil interests. I mean, certainly the West, whether it's Europe or the United States, the big energy companies here would love to get their hands on that.
What I love is the people are called economic fundamentalists, and they say we are never going to run out of anything because human ingenuity will solve the problem. We're going to go and mine the moon or something like that. And you look at the energy balance and all of those, it's negative. It takes more energy to get out than you put in. And if you look at something like tar sands, for every barrel of oil you put into the process, you're getting 1.5 to 2 back. And that isn't viable. Human society needs to get back at least 8 for every 1 it puts in, because otherwise you can't create the surplus in order to put into things like hospitals and schools and that sort of thing. So 50, 60 years ago, after the Second World War, our energy systems produced 100 barrels for every 1 barrel of energy we put in. And when the North Sea started, it was about 40 for every 1 we put in. And the latest North Sea, the deep water, that's down to about 20 for every 1 we put in. And so it isn't just this idea of the availability of energy, how much is actually flowing. It's the return, what we have to put in to get out. And at the moment, that is almost approaching parity.
What about a final sort of topic to look at, Paul, is this whole idea of clean coal. A firm has been claiming just a couple of weeks ago it's the world's first commercially viable zero-carbon power plant that could be a game-changer. This is Ian Johnston, who's the environment correspondent at The Independent. The company boss says the inventor of this new technique should get a Nobel Prize. A revolutionary technique to capture carbon emissions from coal-fired power stations has been shown to work on a commercially viable basis for the first time, the company behind it's claimed. If true, the breakthrough could allow coal to continue to be burned on a large scale around the world without actually producing the greenhouse gases that cause climate change. The Anglo-Indian firm Carbon Clean Solutions Limited produced its research, part funded by a 4.2 million grant from the UK government, and he said it could be a game changer. While carbon capture and storage systems have been tested on power stations, they've remained too expensive to make commercial sense until now.
It's better. It's definitely better. The two points are, number one, they've managed to shrink the amount of energy it takes to capture the carbon by about 20%. That still means you're using a fifth of the energy the power station generates to put the carbon into a form you can capture it. And then you have to find somewhere to put it, which is doable because we have all those old North Sea oil wells. So in the short term, it could be good. But in the long term, how much coal is there? Now, the industry loves to tell you there is so many years of coal. In the USA, the last few years, they've reassessed how much coal they've got, particularly places like the Powder River Basin in Wyoming. And they've been coming back with figures of 5 or 6% of what they actually thought they had, they can get out the ground. And so again, a lot of these ideas for how much coal we have in the world are based on assumption using very back-of-the-envelope calculations for the size of coal seams in the area. When you actually look to go and dig these things up, you find there's a whole lot less than you thought there was. People keep saying, you know, we've got 200 years of coal in Britain. We haven't. With current mining technology, we've got somewhere between 10 and 20. Most of the coal we're digging up now is coming from open cast, from places like South Wales, where they're taking the last bits of mountain top off. And so, yeah, coal might be clean coal might be a short-term way of doing that. But all you're doing is creating a problem of where you put literally millions of tons of effluent, which has to be put somewhere where it's not going to come back to the biosphere. And we can only do that for a certain amount of time before we run out of space to put it, assuming the coal exists.
Well, there certainly is quite a bit in South Wales, Paul, isn't there?
This is a fallacy. There is coal there, but you couldn't get it out because of the geology means it wouldn't be viable to sink huge shafts down to where it is and exploit just a small pocket, because the way the ground is fractured means you can't have huge coal fields running for miles. You can only have very small ones taking out little pockets of coal. That's why they've gone to things like open cast, because that is the last viable coal we have in Britain. Now, there is this idea called underground coal gasification. Our government was all for this. In fact, it gave a huge loan guarantee to one of the companies wanting to do it. All those companies are now going into liquidation because they tried this in Queensland in Australia. Basically, you set fire to a coal seam underground, and a bit like the old town gas works, it produces gas, which you can then burn at the surface. They've contaminated an area around the site for 320 square kilometres with poisonous gases. And the view is that in 20 or 30 years, when those gases make it to the surface, it will kill the local agriculture. And the Queensland government is now facing hundreds of millions of claims for damages because the company's gone into liquidation and walked away.
Well, amazing. Anyway, Paul, it's been absolutely fascinating listening to you. Could you give us just some tips as to, I know you've written books, you've also got websites, that sort of thing. Whereabouts can we go to follow up some of your research?
The easiest one is to put my name into a web search. Most of it's true. But my website, Paul Mobbs, or Mobbs Environmental Investigations, that has lots of my old work on articles, even some very embarrassing videos, because most of my work is paid for by communities, so I put all my work online so that other communities can look at it and do something with it as well.
And what about books?
I've written various books. There's one called Energy Beyond Oil, which is just about available. That's all about peak oil in Britain and what it means for the future. I've written various books on... I used to do lots of work with journalists and human rights workers in Africa and the former Soviet republics, helping them get stories out about getting their heads kicked in by the secret police. And there's books on my website about that, how to use the internet safely, how to use free software, alternatives to Windows. Some of my latest work is around drones and surveillance technology, and I'm hoping there's a book coming out next year on fracking, if all goes well.
Well, since you've just mentioned that surveillance stuff, I'm going to ask you before you go just quickly about the Israeli role, if you know anything about it, in surveillance. There's a very good article just last week on The Intercept, which is based in Brazil, a very good surveillance website, was publishing a lot of the Edward Snowden revelations. This is Alex Kane writing. He says, in 1948, the year Israel was founded, the Meir Group was established as a metal company. Today it's very different. It operates a dozen subsidiaries and employs 1,200 people in 40 countries, selling wireless infrastructure and software for public transit, ticketing systems, wastewater treatment, and much more. The Meir's evolution came from cutting metal to electronic snooping and reflects a larger shift in the Israeli economy. Now, this is the sort of technology that Britain really could be dying for. They're absolutely right at the cutting edge of doing a lot of this surveillance technology. I mean, the main question really being, can you actually trust this software? Because you do wonder if it's being used in different countries for surveillance, whether the people who wrote the software have got access to it by one means or another.
The Israelis are the country developing drones, autonomous drones, surveillance capabilities, cyber war capabilities. And particularly things like drones and surveillance, that's because they have a whole country they practice it on to get it right. And in the end, it comes down to, when you get a computer program, are you allowed to look at the code? And this is the fundamental difference between, let's say, Windows and Linux. With Windows, it's proprietary. You're not allowed to reveal what's in the code. Whereas with Linux, it's what's called open source. You can look at the code, you can understand how it works, and if you don't like it, change it. And all these things tend to be what they call proprietary systems. It's like a black box. You buy the black box and plug it in, and you have not a clue what's working inside. But again, this whole construct of intellectual property rights, black boxes, proprietary rights, it's all about control and growth. Governments needn't do this. There are plenty of open source alternatives. The whole internet runs on open source because it's cheap, because you haven't got all these proprietary rights extracting money. So the government is probably going for this company, again, because of lobbying. And there are alternatives available.
There's the Privacy International this year is a watchdog group that investigates government surveillance, released a report on the global surveillance industry. It identified 27 Israeli surveillance companies, the highest number per capita of any country in the world. The unit 8200 veterans either founded or occupy high-level positions at least 8 of the Israeli surveillance company named by Privacy International, according to publicly available information. So certainly it seems, I mean, it's the first time I've come across this. I had no idea that the Israelis were so massively involved in all this. Yeah. And you've just mentioned drones too.
Oh, they are the people in drones. The bloke who runs the Reaper and Predator drone projects in America for the American government is a former Israeli.
Amazing. Anyway, Paul, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Thank
on
you.
The Politics Show this week.
Thank you.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
We'll have a look now, as I said when I was chatting with Paul just there, we're going to have a listen to an extract from this review of the documentary Vaxxed. And the man that started the controversy over the links between the MMR vaccine, given to really tiny tots literally just after they were born, was this chap, Dr. Andrew Wakefield. And as I said to Paul just there, if you go everywhere on the internet, you'll find almost everybody saying, or most of the web searches you'll do, say, oh, he's been discredited. But actually, this film Vax shows that there is in fact a whistleblower, a very important whistleblower at the US Center for Disease Control, and it's pretty clear that big money is trying to cover up links between the vaccine and autism. So let's hear one of the latest interviews and a review of the Vaxxed film from Andrew Wakefield now.
This is what we hear from the media, isn't it? We don't know what causes autism, but we know that vaccines don't. And it's actually a very straightforward story. It's not complex at all. Autism isn't this enigma. It's the disease of the last 100 years. It's appeared, it's gone from vanishingly low levels to now, as you say, potentially affecting one in two children by 2032. That is the most alarming epidemic that we've ever seen. I mean, it is absolutely extraordinary and will destroy the economy, will destroy the social infrastructure of this country and other countries around the world. I was looking at India just the other day. One in 66 children in India now have autism. They didn't even have a word for autism before it suddenly appeared out of nowhere. Now, the questions that have been raised about this, or the issues that have been put forward by the psychiatrists and psychologists, the experts, is that it's not a new disease, it's always been there, we just didn't recognize it. Or we're changing the diagnostic criteria, and children we historically called mentally retarded are now being called autistic, or we're just getting better at making the diagnosis. Now, those are reasonable ideas, they've been tested, and they're not true. It's important to bear in mind that the best diagnosticians in the history of medicine are not of this century or the last century, but of the century before. So, for example, like Charcot or Tourette, the great French physicians of the late 18th century. So, had autism existed, it would have been described. Now, go back to the clinical history, because this is the key. If you do not know the cause of the disease, listen to the patient or the patient's parents, because they will give you the clues. And the parents were saying they weren't anti-vaccine, they took their children to be vaccinated on time, but this is what happened to their child. they regressed into autism following the MMR vaccine. Now, we had to take that extremely seriously. They were right about the bowel disease. The medical profession was almost to a man and a woman wrong and said, there's no problem, it's just autism. So when they were right about the bowel disease, we have to take the association with the MMR vaccine extremely seriously. And I believe that after all of the investigations we've done, they were right. And medicine says, well, parents are just looking for something to blame. No, they're not. Medicine is looking for something to blame. Medicine historically blamed the parents. It was the refrigerator mother who the child wanted to die because the mother was ice cold and hated them. This was the medical perception of autism in the very beginning. And then it was genetic. It was the parents' fault again. No, it's not genetic. You don't have genetic epidemics. And now the medical profession is trying to exonerate vaccines and blaming the parents again for themselves, looking for something to blame. So it's this circuitous argument that in fact comes down to the medical profession not having the answers and blaming the parents for the problem. People need to understand the seriousness of this issue, and we're at a critical juncture now in American history. This, I believe, we face the end of the First Republic of the United States of America if we do not act in the interests of the citizens rather than the corporations. And I think that we need to make some very, very difficult decisions about this. We need to stop being afraid. We need to stop being intimidated by the CDC and the pharmaceutical industry. We need to see them for what they are. And we need to take responsibility. Individuals need to take responsibility for this. It's no good just saying, what can I do? I can't do anything. It's too big for me. The underbelly of this whole system is the public saying, no, we no longer have confidence in what you're saying. We will make the decisions about what goes into our bodies and the bodies of our children. That is our right.
Well, that's Dr. Andrew Wakefield there, who supposedly discredited, but actually a fantastic amount of money seems to have been spent on trying to discredit him by people like Merck, the massive United States pharmaceutical company. And you can find out a lot more about that, very much up to date. It's Robert De Niro's film festival that vaxxed. The VAXXED, the film all about it, was due to be shown, and then it was pulled at the last minute. And there are quite a lot of interviews around on YouTube, online, etc., which go into the content of that film and take a really good look at the evidence behind it, because it seems pretty clear that these people involved, the professionals, got it wrong at an early stage. It's trying to say that there was no connection between MMR and autism, and now the things have gone so far that they just don't dare admit that they were so horrifically wrong. Rather frightening story there. And that was, as I said, Dr. Andrew Wakefield, you just heard.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now, Asma Al-Assad is not a name we hear very much, but she's actually a British person. She was born here in Britain and brought up here, and she's the First Lady of Syria. She's the wife of President Assad. Now, many people have asked her over the years, so she says, about why she stayed in Syria since there's a civil war going on. Wouldn't it have been a lot easier to leave? But she says that actually the reason that she stayed is because she thinks it's actually very important to stay in her country rather than to run off. So anyway, let's have a listen to a recent interview with her, because we hear so little about Asma Assad on the media here, and I think we should hear a little bit more. So here she is.
First of all, I've been here since the beginning, and I never thought of being anywhere else at all.
In Syria,
and secondly, yes, I was offered the opportunity to leave Syria, or rather to run from Syria. These offers included guarantees of safety and protection for my children, and even financial security. It doesn't take a genius to know what these people were really after. It was never about my well-being or my children. It was a deliberate attempt to shatter people's confidence in their president. And suffice to say, these offers were foolish and not even made by people who were Syrian. Why was the fate of the children in Zara not given the same media coverage as the tragedies of Aylan and Omran? The Western media decided to focus on these tragedies because it suited their media agenda. It's actually the West that is dividing our children in this conflict according to the political beliefs of their parents. Aylan was a Syrian child. irrespective of what his parents believed, as was Omran and the other innocent children in the Zara village massacre. These are all children. They are all innocent children. And they are all a loss to Syria, irrespective of which side of the conflict we support. And as a Syrian, I am personally saddened by the loss of every single child, whether it's Aylan or Omran or the many, many others whose names did not reach Western headlines. Ultimately, humanitarian aid should not be determined by geography, political orientation, or religious belief. It cannot be allowed to be driven by political agendas.
Asma al-Assad there, the Syrian First Lady. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 now. Coming up, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. And also our sister show Dialect airs on BCFM here at noon every Tuesday. Our show page for your comments is thisweek.org.uk. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
News on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.